And then he said, well, do you think anything like that could happen today? I says, well, maybe not exactly in that form, but the fact that in this day and age, you have three of the top labor leaders in the province of Quebec in jail shows that it could happen again. And he said, well, yes, but they broke the law. And of course, so did the Winnipeg General Strike. They broke the laws that were made specially for that purpose. And the trade union movement, although it certainly has come a long, long way from the 1919 General Strike, still finds many of its rights quite tenuous. The right to strike, which is the basic right of the working class, can be upset by court injunctions, by special government legislation, and so on. And then the workers are faced with the idea that if they continue to resist, they will be breaking the law, and if they don't continue to resist, they will lose their cause. And I think there is a similarity in that sense between what went on in 1919 and what has happened with the three Quebec labor leaders in who are still in jail.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to mention that the 1919 strike as well. Then all the Quebec leaders, they know a lot of much about the preacher now, but and you all of them, and well, I wasn't involved very much with this. Trying to affect myself, and then, as a matter of fact, I was, we were 15 then on, like now, it was off of Swiss Canadian over network. At that time, they know they had the special policemen, they know all those that come back from the war, just putting a banner on their arm, they know they gave $6 a day, the special for punishment duty. And we know while we were in the sidewalk and on watching the plan, the ladies working there before. And a couple of years before I come over and they know me on my shoulder, they know. And the other fellow was with me, they know you're wrong. They never thought that. Because myself, that's the same, you're wrong. I ain't doing anything. So at that time, they know they say, so get on, you know, they used to have this motorcycle, the sidecar at the point. They took me down to the immigration hall over there, the sergeant in there, just in the back of the CPR station over there. And the sergeant in there, what's this in for? Oh, so you're going to investigate. All right. So they went out. In the meantime, then the lunchtime comes along, then also I got 3 meals. And so they come back and say, okay, come with me then also. He took it down then, I just said, yes, I'm forward to Maine down there. And the room was up a window grilling. He says, you sit outside for a while. Okay, so I sat in there for a while, and then they called me in. The fellow inside says, well, he says, we got nothing against you. The only thing is, yeah, I came from Italy, you see. I didn't have no identification. Started to show I was an Italian, you know, and at that time, you know, people, it was a war with the, against the Allies, you see. So, at the same time, you know, we had the meeting of the Winnipeg Tribune. It's all the super of the Winnipeg, you know. Well, they used to take a little bit part in the labor movement at that time, and we used to have a meeting in there. In this building, you know, all the delegates from the different municipalities, you know. I told them the story, you know, what happened, you know. That's why I was...
The last time we were talking with you, Mr. Pritchard, we left you in the Stony Mountain Penitentiary, which was really cruel of us, but we had no other alternative. Now, we'd like to... talk mainly about the 30s, but before we do, what was your political activity from the time, during the period from the time you were released from Stony Mountain Penitentiary until the 30s? Were you actively engaged in political activity?
Not too much.
I was recuperating.
You were recuperating?
Yes.
Were you...
From jail, you know.
Yeah. Did you run in any provincial or federal elections?
Oh, yes. In the Nanaimo coalition from Northfield South to Squamish, it took in the fishing towns of Sook and East Sook and all the Gulf Islands, including Hope Bay.
What year was that?
Excluding Victoria, 1921.
And under whose auspices were you running?
I ran as a socialist candidate.
And were there other socialist candidates running?
Not there, no.
No, I mean in the...
Oh, there may have been, yes.
This was a provincial election or a federal?
No, a federal.
Oh, a federal election. And how many votes did you get?
Not enough. But I had a majority in Nanaimo, the provincial constituency of Nanaimo, that scared them. And at Sook and East Sook, where I didn't visit, I got a big majority, which might suggest that you can do better if you don't go to places like your election. I also got a good vote in Duncan.
What was the general vote for socialist candidates in BC at that time, do you think? How did the other socialist candidates in British Columbia do?
Oh, well, none were elected. None was elected.
No, but socialists like to count their votes, whether they're elected or not.
I know, but you're dealing with a period in my life which was not to me that important. We counted votes, so there's the barometer. Then I ran here in New Westminster.
What year?
Against, I forget the year, but it was about the same time. And this was a Dominion election. Later.
Well, it must have been 25. The next election after 21 was 25. Was your vote increased from 1921?
Well, it was a different constituency.
Yeah.
I had no way of measuring that.
And what would be the normal activity of the Socialist Party of Canada that you were a member of in those days?
Well, they ran candidates.
For what?
Chiefly for propaganda purposes, you know.
And what did they do in between elections?
Oh, they issued their periodicals, they held meetings. After that, of course, I had to rest up some more. Because I came out of the Winnipeg business weakened physically. And this deafness is a part of it.
The reason I'm asking this these questions of prior to the 30s, because I want to establish at what point the Socialist Party of Canada decided to join the new party, the CCF.
Oh, I don't know that they did as a party.
Uh-huh.
There were members that joined it as individuals.
And you were one of them.
The Socialist Party dissipated over the split, as I told you. Some of them were wanting to take the 21 points from Moscow and adopt them.
Well, you joined the... You were a foundation member of the CCF.
No, no.
No?
No. I was attached to them, but...
How do you mean attached to them?
Don't give me too much importance. I wasn't there at that.
But of course,
I came to it a little later.
What year? Because I have here that you were first president of the BC CCF Association.
What happened was there's a group organized, of which one was Mrs. Steves and Professor of Horticulture at UBC and a few other people.
Wallace Lefoe?
No. There was a small group still called itself the Socialist Party of Canada.
You weren't part of that group?
No. And they are the ones that became the BC section of the CCF at the beginning. But the idea caught on and clubs sprang up all over the place. So these people organized a Reconstruction Party. And they came to me and bothered me. And I didn't want to be bothered. Got me into it and I became president of that. We held a convention in the Stanley Park.
Convention of what? Of the Reconstruction?
Of these people, yes. And what to do about it.
Yeah.
They decided to organize a CCF clubs then.
Yes. And you joined them?
I was the president then.
Oh. So you were the president of the CCF clubs in British Columbia?
No, I was president of the Reconstruction Society. And just for a short time, get the thing going. When they decided to join the CCF, they ceased to be what they were originally. They became CCF clubs in the communities in which they lived.
Yes.
A series of clubs.
And what happened to the Reconstruction Society?
Well, when someone gives up the ghost, you know what happens.
So
they decided to become CCF clubs. Now, if you are something and you decide to become something else,
yes,
then you cease to be what you were, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Were you at the Regina Convention of the CCF?
Yes.
And you helped formulate the Regina Manifesto?
I think perhaps I wrote a preamble to something, to some section.
Uh-huh.
I think if you look at it, you'll find the...
Do you recall that convention at all?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Not as vividly as I recall the strike, you know, or the trial.
How is that? It's early. It's later.
Hmm?
That's an interesting point. You remember the Winnipeg General Strike, which was 50 years ago, but you cannot remember as easily what was 40 years ago.
I can remember 2.5 years going to school.
Yes. Yes.
And that's a lot further back than
yeah.
that. There are things you remember that strike your memory, you know.
Yeah.
It would be altogether too awful if you retained memories of everything, wouldn't it?
Well, the reason I'm coming at this is because the Regina Manifesto was the foundation program of the CCF.
Yes.
And it had sections of it which were socialist in content.
Uh-huh.
Do you agree?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
The term in a broad sense.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering to what extent that was done as a result of people like yourself who were socialists and who were joining this new party to make it a socialist party.
Well, there were quite a number of them. From BC.
Yes.
I had something to do with that. I think I was on one committee, a small committee. And that is why I drafted the preamble to... maybe it's the manifesto itself, but I'm not quite sure. If I could look at it, I could pick it out.
Well, of course, you know, did you consider the CCF at that time as a socialist party?
In the sense in which it was put forward.
Yes.
As I told you this morning, I consider a socialist movement to be a much wider and deeper, more profound movement than any of the parties that have any kind of names that might contain the term socialist in them. To me, it is that movement taking place in society in which one, without being conscious of it, becomes moved or influenced by a changing ideology. We all have it.
Were you a member of the CCF at the time that you ran for Reeve of Burnaby?
Oh no, because this came after I was out of Burnaby. That was 1932 and this was 33, wasn't it?
Yes. So, how did you come to run as Reeve of Burnaby? Were you active in the community there, or?
Oh no. I had taken a little house on Capitol Hill, and it's still there. And got to know my neighbors. They came and talked. Some of them were interested in music, and we got talking about this and that. And they said, "You come up to a ratepayers meeting." And I went there and I asked a question or two. Then there were people came around afterwards and said, "You should run for the council." I said, "Oh, that's too much." Then the same people, together with others, came the next year. And they said, "Look, we want you to run for Ward 4, the council." And as with other people, there are moments of flippancy, you know. And I just stopped, so I said, "No, I should have two good reasons. One is that the company wouldn't be good enough and the pay wouldn't be high enough." Well, next year, to get rid of the thing, I said I would run. And I carried the place by 13 votes. If you're superstitious, that's ominous. But I carried it. But the people that urged me, I have two in mind right now, to run 2 years in succession, came out on the side of the other fellow who came from Vancouver. He must have had some property up there. He ran. And this was a crime with which I was charged, that I was interested in the money, which at that time I think was $25 a month. And if you had a broken down car, it wouldn't have paid for the gas to get to the municipal office. Because one had to come from North Burnaby to Renfrew Street, over to the south, and along Kingsway to the hall, which was almost in New Westminster. And as this lady that's writing the book on Burnaby said, "It's different now." I said, "You are telling me?" Well, she said, "It's not a divided community now." I said, "It was then. Anyone in the north that had to pay taxes had to go to the hall to pay them, and they had to make this circuitous trip. There were no roads north and south. There was a road that ran through from Vancouver called Douglas Road, but even Gilmore Avenue didn't reach it. None of these avenues going south went far enough. That was one of the first things I did, have them cut through the bush. We got through Spurling Avenue again. We could get to the hall through Spurling Avenue. Furthermore, the next thing was to make an agreement with the banks that people could pay their taxes at the bank, like they do at telephone bills and all. Then we opened an office in the north.
A municipal office?
Huh?
A municipal office.
A branch office.
Yes.
Where they could transact business. This was a day's trip.
Yes.
These were the things I did.
So you were elected Reeve on your first try?
Yeah, the first North Burnaby man to be Reeve.
So in the campaign that got you elected, you must have received a lot of support in the campaign. People coming around to help you?
Oh yes, that's all we had too.
Yeah, yeah. Who were they, mostly trade unionists?
Our neighbors, yes, interested in generally working people.
Burnaby was a working class.
Burnaby at that time was what I would call a dormitory for New Westminster and Vancouver.
Were most of the people workers there?
They worked in the town area there, even policemen. Vancouver policemen lived in Burnaby.
What?
Then was the railroad shops, CP. In the south was the Canadian National, Fort Mann. The rest were loggers, fishermen, and miners. And these were our taxpayers.
And these are the people that supported you?
Well, yeah, for that ward, yes. Now, let's say I carried the, oh, you're speaking about the election for Reeve.
Yes.
I beat a man that had been Reeve for many, many years. And many had tried to crack his nut. I didn't have a headquarters, but I had friends. And Watergate could tell you, you don't need a lot of money. What I did have were friends in gas stations and barbers in the barber shops. Now, these were the agents of propaganda, and you dropped your little seeds and you went along and they expanded on them. And if you could tell a good joke, that was the thing that counted.
So when you became Reeve,
beat McLean, and that is policy, as most people knew, and I named it a barrel full of gravel and a half-inch pipe. There wasn't a water main in Burnaby when I went in that was bigger than 3/4 of an inch. And when I left, they had a plan for water in which the mains were 4 inches and 6 inches with fire plugs properly placed. That's the plan I had to put through by guile.
And was it carried through?
Yes. It was carried through without being noticed. The people who voted for it didn't know they were voting for it. And I couldn't have done it any other way. The way you go at it, you see, especially when you on a council of 7, in which 4 are opposed to you on almost every measure, the only redress you have is to veto the stuff you don't like, and so it would kill the motion. Then let it hang for a while and get round it, like the Japanese got around the Americans over the surcharge. This is what happened. I suggested to the council that the engineers be instructed to prepare a plan to cover the next 20 years for Burnaby's water supply. Yeah? All right. Now, they didn't adopt the plan, they just gave him instructions to prepare it. And then that plan was finished, I discovered that this could be registered and could not be challenged. It registered the same way. And just a little law dug up, this could be registered in the same way as a piece of property. So I took it to Victoria, to the provincial secretary, and I laid it before him. I said, that is what we have for Burnaby as a possibility for the next 20 years. And he looked it over thoroughly, and I said, what do you think of it? He said, I think it's excellent. I said, would you certify that? He said, of course I would. I got him to put his seal on it, approve it, see. That's it. I took it back to the council and I reported what had happened. Now, it wasn't that if Bill Pritchard had done it, it was murder. But the provincial secretary of the provincial government put a seal on it, voted for it unanimously. And the very next month after that, plan was adopted, the premiums on fire policies went down in Burnaby almost to the same rate as they were in the city of Vancouver. They didn't look far enough. These items meant something to people of Burnaby. I tried to get Hastings Street widened. You wouldn't know about that, but these people know. You went out of Vancouver, not east. And when you hit the boundary, it bottlenecked. With just one half of the street paved, and the other half gravel, and the streetcar track up the middle. And I wanted to get it widened on that side to the same as Vancouver. We made all kinds of offers, they rejected it, 30 years later, they come to it, when it cost them thousands and thousands of dollars more than it would have if they'd done it at that time. Now, there's many of these instances.
Well, did you have, in Burnaby when you were Reeve, a big problem about unemployment relief?
Oh, yes. in the Depression?
Yes.
What we had in Burnaby as taxpayers were workers.
Yes.
The only income we had practically was our main income book, was the taxes. So now, I'm in the position of having to provide relief out of the taxpayers' money that wasn't being paid in order that the taxpayers wouldn't die of starvation. Now, there's the problem in a nutshell.
So how did you ever solve that problem?
I started the ball rolling to Mackenzie King. And that gentleman said that from all appearances, there was no evidence of any unemployment in Canada. That when the storm was breaking, see. Oh, of course, when Albie Bennett came in, there's another story, because this gentleman promised to cure unemployment in 3 months.
Yes.
And I charged him with it in Calgary.
Where, at a public meeting?
Yes.
Was he there?
A meeting of mayors and Reeves and the ministers of the Western Provinces. Of course he was there in the chair. And he gave them, in turn, he gave them all a lecture. The Reeve of some small burg in Saskatchewan gave a picture of his position. The response from Bennett was that, looking at the record, 35 years ago your municipality defaulted. And that went, that was his whole argument against every one of them. Brushed them off. They sat there in awe, you know. Well, I was president of the BC Municipal Union, and when my name was called, I pointed out that I was representing not only Burnaby, but all those municipalities in British Columbia not here represented. And I said, Mr. Prime Minister, I'm perfectly willing to take my share of the verbal castigation that has been handed out this morning. He said to his secretary, any verbal castigation? You know, he blurted at you. And he excused himself. Well, I said, I'll let that pass, and I'll allow that perhaps I don't quite understand the English language. Then I gave him the story. Municipality and town after town in British Columbia, and what we were faced with. Then I gave him a short picture of world conditions, to which he nodded, and the states. And this is a condition, Mr. Prime Minister, which is not of your doing and one over which you have no control. This is a matter of economics. We are now in that period of capitalist movement that is called depression, as against periods of prosperity. But I do recall a distinguished gentleman running for office some time ago who promised, if elected, he would see to it that unemployment was cured in 3 months. That date, Mr. Prime Minister, has long since gone by. Now, what I want to talk to you about is that unemployment has not been cured, and people in these municipalities are facing starvation, and some of them worse than that. And it's your responsibility to do something about it. Well, out of that grew then the arrangement whereby the federal government and the provincial government and the municipalities would take equal responsibility and share for relief. Fortunately, we had been able to float bonds at a premium covering water, the same scheme I'm talking about, sewers and roads for Burnaby. And immediately, that's our section of the unemployment relief. The two governments provided for other work, unskilled workers, clearing lanes and preparing parks and whatever. So our first scheme covered so much of the two governments' programs. Now the municipalities had to carry all the overhead. We had to do all the bookkeeping, and we had to report in detail, in triplicate. And having done that, then we waited for some payment on the first scheme. And we didn't get any. We have to start the second scheme without any money from the government. Now a word comes from Victoria. This is bureaucracy. That after all this paperwork and this triplication, we are now informed that they require quintuplicates. So it all has to be gone over again, and back I go to Victoria, and we wait. And this time I started correspondence with Ottawa, analyzed it, corresponded with Victoria, analyzed that, and I answered each according to what I figured. And making a long story short, I came out in public and announced that someone in Ottawa or in Victoria is lying. There's the documents. What transpired was the Dominion government sent its share of the funds to Victoria, and they held on to them. Now, the men who are digging ditches to put in sewers, and are putting in water, and are building roads, were skilled workers under contract with the municipality, to which I was a party. The first time I was on the other side of the table in negotiations. I made that contract. And in that contract we set down 25 cents a day more for the sewer workers that had to go down deep ditches as against the men on top. 25 cents. That's another story. There came a time when our finances were shot, except for what we had in the sinking funds. So you pay these workers, who most of them had been steady workers on the municipality, you pay them wages at the end of the week, but the other poor beggars who need it more, we haven't any money for you. What position would you take? The legal one or the moral one? That's what I put up to the government. And I was accused in over on a radio show in Victoria that I had dipped into the sinking funds. Dipped? I would have dived into the sinking funds. And as I told the lady from Burnaby the other day, if I was faced with the same situation at this time, I would do precisely the same thing. To see men and their children going hungry who had worked and there was no wages. And you know what happened? There were interested people, so interested that they gathered a committee together and they went down from door to door as though they were asking for contributions to the Red Cross or something, for 2 bits, 15 cents even, 50 cents. And what's this for? We're getting a fund to bring Reeve Pritchard into court. And they got it. And they brought him into court, along with the chairman of finance and the treasurer. So, you take this also on a legal basis and argue legalities like that. We had a municipal lawyer, Macquarie. I think he became a judge later. He was a member for Westminster. But this was the stand he wanted to take. I fired him. We took him on from North Vancouver, a liberal member he was then. And so we told the story and pleaded guilty. Now when you plead guilty to a charge in a court, a judge has only one thing to do, or at least two. You can either pass sentence then or there, or suspend. I wasn't given a suspended sentence, but the whole trial was placed in a state of suspension. And Judge Gregory said, and I got hell from the communists for this, because he said in court, this man saved Burnaby from revolution. You know, I shouldn't have done that. And he attacked me for it. But what I will do, he said, is leave this in suspension and I will send it to Victoria and request the government to legalize the acts of the chairman of finance and the treasurer and the Reeve of Burnaby. At that time, we were almost at the end of our fifth project and we still didn't have a penny from the provincial government for the first one. So they were after my scalp. We got over that.
What happened?
Oh, I just thought was talking about it. Then we had a meeting of Reeves and Mayors in Victoria, before the cabinet. Whew. This is the time that boys were being chased from town to town and province to province and jumped into jail because they had no place to sleep, nothing to eat.
You mean this was the time of the On to Ottawa trek?
Prior to that. Uh-huh. And we lay the question before the provincial government. This government that was holding on to funds that didn't belong to them and were also holding on the funds that they were obligated to pay out on their share of relief to this community. I don't know if other municipalities were treated the same.
It was the Tommy government still, 33.
But at that meeting, we listened to a rather pious discourse from a cabinet minister by the name of Howe, who drew the idyllic picture of his mother making candles out of beef tallow, of spinning the yarn and making their clothes and so on. He said, why don't the lakes are full of fish and the rivers are full of fish, and what? Well, I pointed out quietly that in the first place, to go fishing, you need a license. None of these boys had a dollar. And it was certain that the kind of yarn that the Honourable Minister's mother spun in the early days was a different kind of yarn that he was spinning now. And that's what I was interested in. Unraveled it. Well, then along came your friend Gideon Robertson. He comes into the picture, see?
Oh, yeah.
And he sat there with the cabinet. He was the man that stopped the relief one day. He sent a man down from Ottawa. I was in Victoria that day. I down came the orders, all relief work stops in Burnaby. And I came home before supper, 6 o'clock at night, off the boat. And everybody's in a panic. So I told some of the boys, get hold of the Veterans Hall there and we'll have a meeting. And I held a meeting. And I declared to the world at large they could send what they liked from Ottawa. The men would go to work the next day and relief would be carried on. It was. But in this meeting at Victoria, Senator Robertson's charge was, and this is why they stopped the relief work in Burnaby, that I was paying 25 cents a day more than the rate set for relief work by the governments. Get it? That's what they put in. So I asked the Honourable Senator, and I reminded him that he had been Minister of Labour, and I told him the 25 cents was paid to men under a contract between employer and employee, that is to say the municipality and municipal workers. And I asked him, as a representative of Labour, what is his intention or wish that I should break a contract between employers and employee that had been peacefully negotiated? That's the 25. Then they brought up other things. But I was running away with money. We were paying more for a truck to carry, you know, they had all kinds of trucks going about on construction. More than they were paying, the provincial government paying for other relief. So we had that meeting with Ralph Bruin. And I went with all the records. Of course we're paying more for a truck. Why shouldn't we? I asked Ralph Bruin. He says, well, you can't do that. I said, we're doing it. Well, then, how much do you pay for a truck? So he told us, this is what we are paying for a truck, so much more, eh? Yes, and that's what we're against. And when you hire a truck, what else do you do? He said, what do you mean? Well, I said, you hire a truck and a driver at so much. Do you buy the gas and the oil? No. Listen, mister, I don't care what you do in Victoria, but no one comes into Burnaby using a Burnaby municipal truck able to get gasoline and oil on municipal funds. When we hire a truck, we hire a truck on the basis of the driver of the truck and the gas and oil and all the rest of it. And we were paying less than they were. All along the line, they tried to fire all that. So that I went to court there, and that was the top shot. You know, this is the amusing thing, and a degree of satisfaction that some act of yours, which technically is illegal, should be ratified by an act of Parliament. I don't know what class that puts you into. But they never did it. It's not been done till this day. And their last words to me in the cabinet meeting was that they had received the request from Justice Gregory and they were willing to do it, provided. Yes, I said, provided what? That I would pay the expenses of the people who brought the action against me. I get mad at the times, and sometimes I say something I would rather not say in polite company, but I can say it here because I said it there. I said, Mr. Premier and gentlemen, this is my word to you, also the word you can pass on to them. Please go to hell. And I picked up my bag and I walked out, and that's the last time they saw me. That's the story of it. And that is where the commissioner came in. The government didn't put him in. I invited him in by means of giving instructions to turn down the first coupon holder that came in to collect on the bond. It was $25 something.
Did you know of any families in Burnaby that lost their homes due to mortgage foreclosure or tax sale?
No. I don't know of any.
Neither of
them. I know that, you see, you've got to deal with a legal question. We had to take houses in default payment. That's the law.
Yes.
All right. Well, I had a treasurer who was smart, he's hard on the ball. The auction will be held. Here again, the commies were in with their stuff, you know, demonstrations. You do this, do that, do the other. They weren't going to see these people turn out their houses. Well, what we did, the lot is put up for auction. It was bid in right away by the municipality. Parcel after parcel, bid in by the municipality. And those people in those houses were put in there by the municipality and kept there. They weren't evicted.
And at the time of the on to Ottawa trek?
Oh, no. That was in what year?
35.
No. No.
When did you...
I finished in 32, as Reeve.
In 32.
Yeah. But I did go to Winnipeg in 32 to the Dominion Municipal Convention. And there were some great papers on finance and engineering and water. I was tail end. I thought, well, you know, I'd be like the biscuit at the end of a meal. And I gave a talk on unemployment. And they not only stopped going out, they started to come back in. And the place was filled. That went over the radio, even while I was speaking. I think it called the Greengrower's they had a radio.
Yeah. Greengrower's Guide.
When I went out the door, Bob Russell is there. He says, Bill, what have you been doing now? I says, what's the matter now? He says, you've got a speech all over town. Yeah? It hit the wires. Well, this I dealt with the question as I saw it as a world problem of a system that is where you have a production in which profit is a motive and in which workers are exploited. And the goods they produce cannot be bought back up with the wages they get. That's simple. This was my argument. And of course, I was paid the tribute of having given an excellent address, but they didn't think it was possible.
What was possible?
My ideas.
Well, did you put forward some proposals?
Yes. That unemployment could not be permanently cured under a price system.
Oh, I see.
In which goods are produced for a world market in competition with various groups. You're coming into that period now, very head on.
Were you?
I told them that I understood their non-acceptance of my ideas from the very social consequences of my ideas being accepted. Yeah? And this, then Russell asked me if I'd like to see Andrews. Remember?
Yeah.
Remember? I said, I wouldn't mind. Now, I'm not itching at all, but if you want to see him, come on, Bill. He says, come on. So we went up to Andrews' office. And he came out. Bob must have been doing some business of some sort with him at that time.
Yes, well, probably because, just to for the purposes of this take, we'll say that A.J. Andrews is the man you're speaking about. This is by way of a footnote. And is the was the Crown prosecutor in the trial in which you were convicted in the Winnipeg general strike.
That's right.
And Bob Russell was one of the strike leaders who was sentenced along with you.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Well,
Bob Russell at that point was the secretary of the Street Rail Women's Union in Winnipeg and head of the OBU Council.
Yeah.
So probably in that capacity, he had something to do with Andrews. Also, they were negotiating for the bakery workers.
I went in there with him, and secretary went, told him that somebody there. He had a client in the office then. He came out and says, Bob, what can I do today for you? Bob said, I'm an old friend of yours here. He looked at me, he didn't know me. He said, from Vancouver. Remember Pritchard? Andrews looked up. Now, in court, he was gray-haired. But these many years later, he had a chestnut brown. So it went... went the other way around.
That made him
and
younger.
He said, oh, shook hands with me. Well, he said, the next thing he said, my brother Bert has been in to tell me that you made a remarkable speech at the municipal convention. Bert was an alderman then, and he was a delegate for Winnipeg. Well, I said, he made a speech. I don't know about remarkable. Well, he said, it's another speech, isn't it? I said, yes. But he said he was quite impressed with it. Come on in. So he went in and he got rid of the other fellow. And he sat and chatted. And he wanted to know this and that. And municipal affairs, what I was doing. And he figured that what I was doing now, at that time, was infinitely better than what he thought I had been doing at a previous time. But then he came to the conditions in the country, in the world, and he wanted to talk about them. And it was pretty terrible. He says, Pritchard, now, what should we do about it? What do you propose? I said, just a minute, mister. Just a minute. I'm not going to give an opinion to a gentleman who helped to send me and did send me to jail for giving those kind of opinions that you're asking for now. And he says, God damn it, you've not changed a bit. That was Alfie. That was Alfie.
Were you...
The man that got under my skin, really, was Isaac. Pitt Bledel.
He had also been a Crown attorney at the trial, didn't he?
Oh, yes. He and Sweetman and Cohen and...
And Andrew.
And then they had a young attorney who, of course, he was, you know, a tyro, I guess. He was studying in Andrew's office, named Goldstein. And he was very dual-looking. And when he whispered, his voice was so beautifully basso profundo, it shook the table almost. And at this time I was given the privilege or the right to take exhibits to the jury and point out, in contradistinction to the Crown, where they had pointed out things, point out other things. And I talked to the jury quietly, and this rumble came through. It was disturbing. And any chance to break the monotony and talk to the judge, I grabbed it. And I said, "My lord, it's quite difficult for me to undertake this task and be disturbed by the, what was the term I gave to them now? Anyway, the thunderings, I had that term in there, of Mr. Goldstein. So you questioned Mr. Goldstein that if he had to whisper to do it quieter. And he said, "I wouldn't let it bother you too much, Pritchard. I wouldn't let it disturb you." This was Metcalfe. I said, "No, my lord, I don't think that I am disturbed. And like the illustrious Goethe, I can say, I always know that I am travelling whenever I hear the dogs bark." So that shut that off.
Did you want to ask a question?
Yeah.
You heard
him?
Are you
here?
No. I want to come back to Burnaby in a minute.
Yeah.
At the time that the commissioner took over, had you still received no funds for your part of relief?
I don't know how they handled it after that. No, we had received no funds.
Not a penny from the government?
No.
What about other municipalities? Were they having the same problem?
I don't know.
You don't know about that?
I don't know their cases.
But
no, ours.
Well, that was what?
North Vancouver municipality went under commissionership,
yeah,
and they went all through the province.
Yeah. So by that was mid-1932?
It's 32.
Still no money.
When
had
I
come
stepped
through.
Out, I stepped out. They pleaded with me to stay until the end of the term. So what I did say to the government was, "I do my best to do the job if I have the tools. And the arrangement is that you have the tools and you're hanging on to them." All we were looking for them was to pay their share. We already had the burden of overhead and the rest of it. That was enough.
So Burnaby didn't get a commissioner because it was bankrupt. It was just because you asked for it.
I asked for it indirectly by refusing payment that was due on a bond, on a Burnaby bond. We defaulted on a bond for $25. We brought in the commissioner. The government didn't want to do it. They wanted me to hang on and then see what happened. See, that we would have faced another election. What they would have done then, I don't know. But I pulled the rug from under them. I said, "That's it." Now I made a little talk to the municipal employees in the hall and told them why, and the council. That was it.
Did you remain living in Burnaby?
I've been accused of running the municipality into a commissionership, into bankruptcy. Yeah, that's how it happened.
So how long did you stay in Burnaby after that? How long did you live in Burnaby after
until
that?
Until 1938.
Till you went?
Yeah. And when I got out of office, all the stipend in those days was $2,000 only, of which was quite a lot of expenses running up and down on the municipal business. I still had coming to me 50% of that. And all I asked for was the treasurer, "Cover my taxes. Charge it to that account." And it was a long time before I got the residue. Yeah.
Were you still chairman of the BC Union of Municipalities at that stage?
Yes.
And so you retained that job, or you had to leave?
Yeah.
You kept it?
Yeah. And I was taken to the next meeting of the municipal union after I was out of office as a guest and given a nice case of pipes. And I've lasted longer than the pipes. They figured out, you know, what they smoke.
Your well, pipes are pretty good.
Yeah. you've got to start digging into for them to come to life, you know.
So, in other words, this period of your 3 years as Reeve of Burnaby was in many ways a re-entry into active political life, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Practically is the word.
Yeah.
That's the only practical experience I had. The rest was just having a good time going after the other fellows, you know. Where in 1916, that goes back a long way,
yeah.
And got up to off at Lund, I think it was Lund, have a meeting there, and the old chap was named Stewart, the Liberal. Not a bad old fellow, but he had lost his sense of humor, if he ever had it. He was that tight. So he blew for a while. We were still on the dock, and I got a meeting going on the dockside, and he got kind of mad. And he said, "I know who's behind Pritchard. I know why he's running in this constituency. The Conservative Party that's behind him." That's the usual stuff. I said, "You're right, Huey, and a heck of a long way behind." So, when I met him again, was in Powell River, and my brother was playing a clarinet in the Powell River band, and they had the band, and they gave me 25 minutes on the platform, which is quite a slice of a meeting. So I put down my brass watch, along with the two other watches, gold watches there, and I said to the chairman, "Don't see they don't get mixed." And I set off. Well, the chairman rapped. He said, "Your time is up. Your time is up." And I kept on going. And then he got louder and louder. "Your time is up," I said. And I pointed to the crowd. "My time is up." Now I said, "You stand for democracy?" The crowd said, "Yes, let's put it to the meeting. All in favor that I continue, say aye." "Aye! Contrary?" And shut up. So I went on for another 20 minutes. Because, after all, he didn't have anything to say. And then they went on. His speech came on, they started to walk out. And they faded away. And even the band that had been paid there to play, it started to wander off, you know. And the tail end of the band, of course, is the drummer going out through the door, and I got up and said, "Mr. Chairman, I can see that the only thing that you and Stewart can beat has already gone out, and I'll follow the drum." And out I went. That was the last of that meeting. Oh, in Cumberland.
Now, that was 1916 you're talking about now. 1916
this was you're talking 16, about. 16, yeah.
Well,
that was some election. That was the election where they voted for the ladies, provincially, and against booze. They brought in the ladies and prohibited booze in this province. And look at it now. Gosh, the beer parlors, of course, are butch more beautiful and sensible than dives. You can see that are high class in the States. But,
Mr. Pritchard, were you religious during that period? Were you religious?
No, you couldn't say that. No.
No, you had no religious affiliation.
Not then, no.
Did you?
I was brought up in a religious atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
In fact, strictly, very strict, if you know.
What?
You couldn't get any stricter.
What was that, Presbyterian?
Chapel or church?
You were still far to the right. or to the left. I wasn't a Jehovah's Witness. They were in existence then. No, Plymouth Brethren. Of the strictest. Now, you know, they come across. I don't bother about it. This girl's father was a friend of mine for 40 years. He knew what I was and I knew what he was. But we had other things to talk about. We had other things to do and we had other interests. He couldn't bother me about my religion, and I didn't bother him about his. We didn't bother about it. But I was interested in their organization of the postal workers. And he was a postal worker. He became a postal worker. I helped organize them. And there's a man in San Jose that Mary knows that writes to me every Christmas and has been writing to me since concerning Nixon. And he was one of these boys in the postal service.
Tell us a little bit more about the organization of the postal workers. Where did you organize them? In Vancouver?
Yeah. But it was behind the scenes. I was behind the scenes. Because the request came to Trades and Labour Council.
Yes.
What I did was quietly on the outside. It was the committee that helped. And what happened is, I remember, they organized the letter carriers.
There was no was there a National Postal Workers Union?
No. They were organizing a letter carriers union, and I think at that time I suggested they hold it, go a little further. Postal workers were inside too, and they got a postal workers union. That was the first step. Then it moved on to civil servants went to work. Immigration officers and customs, they were separate. There's a Civil Services Federation, I think, that covers the whole works now. And you can say this about postal employees and the Postal Service in Canada. The employees are, I think, much better paid. They don't work on Saturday. They don't deliver mail on Saturday. And as far as I'm concerned, they haven't been delivering any day, really. But you have a good postal service, by and large.
So did you succeed in organizing the postal workers then?
They succeeded. I wasn't in that picture too much, but it's there. And that's why these fellows, I guess some of them are dead now, I forget some of the names, Mary, they always look to me, you know, they come to me, see me.
Did you organize any other unions?
The International Timber Workers here.
International Timber Workers?
Yeah.
That part of the AFL?
It was then.
And I guess it became part of the...
I don't know what it became. I think it probably became non-S now. And something else took its place. Now, I don't know, the timber workers here, they belong to the Canadian, isn't it? Congress?
Canadian Labour Congress.
Yeah. The IWA.
The IWA.
That is International
Woodworkers Association.
Yeah. That covers the loggers and
everything. That covers the loggers and everything, yes.
Oh.
There used to be an organization called the Lumber and Sawmill Workers.
Yeah.
And then there was the IWA.
Yeah.
And now they're just the one union.
Well, we tried to organize there the one mill. I was working there at the time. The first obstacle you reach is, all right, if you fellas down there want to organize, the sawyers and filers, right, will have their own organization. I had to battle against that.
So you organized on an industrial line?
Yes, just then. And then, of course, I left the mill because it closed down when we were starting to move, and I had to get a job, so I went to the waterfront. I didn't organize that. It was there when I joined.
You had been a member of that organization
The longshoreman?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I was in the auxiliary first and was president of the auxiliary. That was divided, they weren't divided. The dock workers against ship workers.
Oh, yeah.
Then it was mother. Now I became president of the union itself. And I came back from Winnipeg in the spring of 1921. I had no job here for me. So I picked up my ticket in the ILA and went back on the waterfront again and stepped into the strike of 1922. Now, you could go through the Winnipeg experience and go to jail and then become a target, and I was a target for these employers. In fact, part of their propaganda was, some of these men have recently been in jail. Some of these men, and I was the only one from Vancouver. The same stuff they've got on the aliens.
So when you organized the Longshoremen's Union after leaving the timber workers?
No, I didn't organize the Longshoremen's Union.
That's right, they were in existence. Yeah.
They sprang up in 1912.
Yeah, and but you joined them.
Yes.
Yeah, and did you become active in them?
Oh, yes. Very much so.
Were you a delegate?
How do you think I was elected president?
You were elected president in 1919, but I'm talking now about 1930s. It must be about.
No, he got
I'm talking about 1922.
Oh, I
see. He mentioned the strike of 22.
That's it.
Oh.
How about telling us about that?
Well, how I got out of the Longshoremen Union, how I got off the waterfront, was that I was barred, top man on the blacklist. Maybe that's why I went round for council in Burnaby. I had nothing else to do. Huh?
Well, there are
there's a gap there, though, isn't there? Yeah.
Well, to come back now to have been Reeve, and you're not now no longer Reeve, but you are active politically. You have begun to become active politically again. What kind of political activity were you in after you left the Reeve ship?
Well, you've already got that. In the Reconstruction Society, you lived a short time and then became dispersed, as it were, or divided into CCF clubs. They grew up without anybody organizing them all over the place.
But didn't that Reconstruction Party reappear in 1937 as the constructive, the constructionist?
No, that's an entirely different group.
It's not the same group?
No. They became CCF clubs.
Yes.
Because there was a great interest then in the idea, the CCF, what came out of Regina. Had there not been CCF clubs, the only section from British Columbia would have been that remnant of the Socialist Party, and it was small. And as you ought to know now, somewhat addicted to rigidity and dogma, which I resent. And that's, I guess, why I wasn't in with them.
So you joined the CCF because you thought it was stronger?
Yeah.
And less dogmatic.
Well, I thought it would go somewhere and do something.
Yeah.
I was mistaken. Movements don't go in always where you expect them to. You know. They take their own course.
But at that time, shortly after the formation of the CCF, and you became president of the BC CCF Club.
I know you're getting it mixed, Norman. I was never president of CCF Clubs. I was only president of a short-lived organization called the Reconstruction Society. There were teachers and professors and whatnot composed it.
And
they dragged me in to become chairman.
Is that 32?
No.
1931? 32?
This was 1933.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, then in 1933 there was a provincial election, wasn't there?
Yes.
And the CCF ran. Did you have anything to do with that?
I ran that.
You ran?
And deliberately chose a place where I couldn't be elected.
Where?
Couldn't be elected now for that matter, that's Point Grey. And my running partner was Frank Buck, who is a very good man on flowers and plants.
Well, here it says, September 2nd, 1934, CCF re-elect W.A. Pritchard. What did they re-elect you as?
Who said that?
This is the Vancouver Sun, I suppose.
Oh, Lord, if you're going to quote newspapers as authorities, just forget it.
Well, then there's a report of...
I told you, we had three newspapers in this town when I was a member of the Trades and Labour Council. And they were all down on us. The World, the Sun, and the Province. And I called them the World, the Flesh, and the Devil. And the one that wanted to pick the latter name could do it on their own. But any one of their reporters could stand on a dime and write a $10 story. And there'd be no truth in it. Suddenly, you don't give me any authority.
So you were never president of the BC CCF Club?
Not that I can recall. They may have looked upon it that. Oh! Reconstruction Society and the clubs. I probably functioned as chairman. I don't remember being officially elected president, but I do know that in the Okanagan they got the notion that I was the leader, whatever that is. Because there's another thing that I detest, and that's the question of leadership.
What's your attitude on that?
Hmm?
You don't think there should be leaders?
No, the labor movement suffers from leadership. What it suffers from is a lack of knowledge. Democracy is something that must come from the bottom, eh? Whatever. And it builds the top itself to do its bidding. Servants, not its dictators.
But you joined the CCF.
Oh, yes.
And you were at the Regina Convention.
Yes.
And were you on the CCF executive in British Columbia?
No.
No. Or the provincial council?
No.
But you ran as a CCF candidate?
Yeah. I guess they were short of material. But I picked the place where a millionaire could be elected. That's about all. You couldn't elect a CCF or NDP member now in Point Grey.
No, that's where
in
you
are. In fact, South Vancouver near us, what is it called now? What do they call them now, a PC?
Yeah.
Progressive Conservative.
Yes. Point Grey here, CCF candidate, that's yeah. You.
So you went in there as the sacrificial lamb.
And a lady named Mrs. Steves, there were three of us.
Mm-hmm. That was Dorothy Steves, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
Now that's about the construction movement.
Yes. All right. Now we've got here an item, April the 27th, 1937. This is from the Vancouver province. Maybe we shouldn't believe them. But it says, new party names Price and Pritchard. Rowdyism at Connell meeting. BC constructives urge consolidation of BC public debt. Now, what?
Well, it is all ancient history.
Yeah.
And it happened. So happened there was some dispute in Victoria. Mr. Connell, the clergyman from Victoria, and a geologist, quite a scientist, and he was the leader. Now, to open up this can of worms is to open an awful wound that people hear about. Not on any academic grounds, but on the ground that the party had elected Mr. O'Connell as the leader in the House, and I'm not in the House. Efforts were made to undermine him, get rid of him, and to promote Harry Winch, which they did. And it wasn't a positive fact on my part that I stayed with Mr. Connell. Just a matter of principle. To have a man elected and not, then have him undermined by the people who elected him so that somebody else could be put in. Well, Harry Winch made it. And he became leader of the group. And he might have been premier at one time, except for the coalition. That's why I don't want to touch this kind of stuff, because I don't think much good comes out of it, but I'll tell you. Harold Winch announced, and I got that from the press, therefore I take it with reservations, that he was resigning his seat in the provincial house because of ill health. But he had a contract with the big liberal electrical firm in New Westminster as a subcontractor, and I think he was interested in that. But what happened, he evidently saw an opening in East Vancouver, and he got nominated for East Vancouver, and anyone that carries their label can be elected there, CCF, NDP or whatever. So Jack Price was a member of the House, and he stayed with Connell. And I know just what Jack Price did in practical ways in helping people. He was a member of the Street Rail Women's Union. And I've been told Jack Price was a fool. Well, I've seen him go to the Compensation Board, and I've seen him go to other boards, put in a lot of time and do some practical work for someone that needed it. That's what you get from the province.
So apparently Connell was expelled from the CCF.
No. I think he resigned then. When he saw that, he resigned.
And he formed this Constructives Party.
No, yeah, well, whatever. It would only last a short time. It was more of a gesture on my part. And I don't know.
So it wasn't really a serious...
I like Mr. O'Connell very much. He's quite a scholar. And he was everlastingly being browbeated and shouted down by the same people that you get today. I'm not going to get into it myself, I'm too old, but you are. You get them. Hmm?
Yes, and so you left the CCF too.
Oh yes, I got out entirely. And then something happened that completely altered my life. But, you remember the fellow that called yesterday, we talked about him? Larry, wakes up and says, this man wrote to me in Los Angeles, and he's after me again on sticking questions. Why this? Why did I do that? You know, what he was after was, why did I join the CCF in the first place, you see? I wasn't going to answer him, because you can't answer that kind of a man. So the way I answered him was that, when a person has lived a long life and has been aware of his development, he'll look back, as I am looking back as I write to you. And I look back and I can remember occasions when I might have done something of account that the circumstances call for, and missed the opportunity. On the other hand, I can remember occasions where I jumped in and did something that had much better been left undone. Also, I can recall instances when the appropriate word would have been in order and I missed it, or the appropriate sentence. And other occasions when I opened my big mouth and realized afterwards that what I had said had been much better left unsaid. This is some years ago, I said, now approaching 80, that is what I have to say to you. And son, when you get to be my age, and you are not able honestly to say that to yourself, you're either a liar, or you need the attention of a psychiatrist. Now that, when he called that day, that was in his craw, see, yesterday.
He was the
one. I spoke to people in town here, they figured what I said was the proper answer. No one else knew what it was all about. Because he knows what I stood for.
In a lot of the clippings that I saw about you, you seem to have been linked for some reason with Wallace LeFou.
Yeah, of course.
Would you
he died this last year.
Yeah, would you tell us something about him?
Well, except that when I came to Vancouver in 1911 and arrived on the 19th of March, which was Friday morning, I went with my dad around the town, and then I went to a meeting in the Empress Theatre, Solstice meeting. And the man was giving a lecture there, and his name was LeFou, Wallace W. LeFou. I told Wally about it a few years back. He said, oh? I said, yes, weren't you there? He said, I don't know. He said, what was I speaking about? Well, I said, search your memory. What was your subject almost all the time? Oh. You were talking about gold. Now, how many ounces of gold of a certain degree of fineness was such and such and yes, he said. Do you want to know something else, Wally? You know who your chairman was? He said, no. He was your brother, Frank. Oh, yes, yes, poor old Frank. Frank had died over the time of talking to me. I saw him not last year before I went out to see him. That was 1911. Now, I came out here, and I mentioned funerals today. There was a fellow in South Burnaby, came from the Soo Line in Saskatchewan. They had a farm down there. And he was a member of our party, and he wrote to me at the time when I was secretary. I had a lot of correspondence with him. And the boys here, at that time, they'd get farm help to take in the crop. He would always send word, and they'd hit the freight, so they'd go down to Graves Farm, and better treated them probably than they would another farm. He came out here and went into real estate. And one time I was visiting, and there's a bunch, he died. Well, they could have gone through the formality, you know, and so on, and it would have been looked after. He didn't want that. They didn't know what to do about it. And this Johnny Aarons, that bookstore, says, Bill, he said, I don't know, what can you do? I said, I don't know. He said, well, would you take it over, funeral service? His wife wanted someone to recite Excelsior, because this was his favorite. Well, I said, all right, and I went out there. And they had a girl that sang. I said sang, but anyway, it was off pitch terribly, whatever it was she sang. And she talked to me, I said, you know, Excelsior is set to music, not only as a solo, but as a duet, and as in four part. Oh, she said, I wish I'd had a copy, I would have sung it for you. Well, I said, just as well, maybe, that you didn't. But that. And then old-timers came along. Now, there was a fellow there, and I learned afterwards that this man had fallen out of his own apple tree
in South Burnaby and was injured, and so he's crippled. And he comes up there, doubled up to me. And he says, "You don't remember me. Jimmy King." I says, "My God, what a memory. I hadn't seen him for nearly 50 years then. And other people that I met, I can remember them." Now, what is the gentleman's given name, the teacher, Mr. Young?
Charles Young? Charles Young.
Well, there he is. He asked me, if you remember, well, it was after the thing was over, yesterday, or the Tuesday, if I remember a meeting in Squamwalt in 1921, and I said, "Of course I do. It's the only one I ever held in Squamwalt. You've no chance to forget that, to get mixed." Well, then he quoted something I'd said, and it brought it to mind. But when that was over, and he came to me, he said, "Do you remember that meeting, that a young fellow sitting on the aisle?" "Not particularly." I said, "It was a crowded meeting." And he smiled. I said, "You mean that was you?" He said, "Yes." Well, I said, "No wonder that I didn't recognize you. If you were just a young fellow, you didn't have a beard then." Well, at that same meeting, there's an old fellow. Not then, he wasn't old, named Holliday, Dan Holliday. And I'd spoken to him then. And at the reception they gave me in Victoria at the time of the celebration of Winnipeg strike, I had a reception there. Up comes this old man. And I said, "Hey, after all these years, a new Holliday?" He said, "Yes. Well, you were at the meeting in Squamwalt." He said, "Yeah, there," he said, "I was going to talk to you about it." See? I don't remember last names very well now. I've got to put them to a test. And,
Well, did you know Lefort at the time of the general strike?
Yes, he came as one of the, he was a lawyer's helper, you know, he was in studying law.
Yes.
And he made a speech in Winnipeg. And Andrews got up and told the court about his speech. And they turned round, pointing to Lefort. "We'll see to it, young man, through the bar of BC, that you don't get any further." They threatened him.
But
he worked with McMurray, and he worked with McMurray afterwards.
And he was a member of the Socialist Party?
Yes. He stayed in Winnipeg,
yes,
after the preliminary hearing,
yes,
helping McMurray in the preparation of the case.
He was also, as I understand, of course you wouldn't know because you were in jail then, but he was the secretary of the Winnipeg Defense Committee.
Yes.
That put out the book.
Yeah.
And organized the defense.
Yes, he did that. And then he took a trip to Russia.
Yes.
And I think he wrote a brochure about Winnipeg, London, and Moscow.
A study in Bolshevism.
Yes. Well, he probably learned something.
And he also accompanied Truman.
Yes.
To take the case to the Privy Council.
Yes. Yes. He speaks of that in the book.
Yes. Yes.
The remarkable thing that Wally came back with was the opinion expressed, and I think it was by Carlson, either Carlson or Birkenhead, and the opinion was the effect that these men were treasonable. This is from the man who organized the shipping of military goods and military forces into Ulster, the early days.
To crush the Easter uprising.
Huh?
To crush the Irish uprising.
They were going to maintain Ulster, anyway.
Yeah.
He was acting against the British Crown.
Oh, he was acting against the British Crown?
Of course.
Oh, I see. And now he was acting for the British Crown?
No.
Well, when he was the head of the Privy Council?
Oh, yeah, that's afterwards. You see, after he pulled this stuff on...
Yes.
On
was Lord Birkenhead.
Making... Was it Birkenhead?
Yes.
Well, now, here's another gentleman. It could have been Carlson, but because Birkenhead was with him anyway, and Birkenhead gets his name because he was a member of Birkenhead. It's across the river from Liverpool.
Yeah. His name was Smith.
Yes. His name was not only Smith, and it wasn't might be, it was. And his name was Frederick E. Smith. And he was known in Lancashire in those days in politics as Frothy Freddy. He was another chap. You see, law and order means to these people what suits them, that it does to the Nixon forces.
So this Wallace LaFoe was a member of the Socialist Party of Canada in British Columbia,
yes,
as you were.
Wallace LaFoe joined the Socialist Party of Canada in Revelstoke in 1903. And he showed me a copy of the first volume of Marx in his writing, his beautiful writing there, you see. Now, down in Matsatlan, there's a fellow named Bennett. He's dead now, and he was 96 when he died. But this was another Bennett, also named William, William J. This was a raconteur of the First Water, this old man, a linguist. Came from Staffordshire, knew Eleanor Marx, and was in Spain when, I think it was Ferrer, was shot, you know, for his educational work. And he told me that he was the one that introduced LaFoe to the movement, and very possibly so. He was then in Revelstoke. Then he became editor of the Fernie Ledger, one of the best Labour papers, because it's well edited and well written. But he goes down to Matsatlan and teaches navigation in the Polytechnic and languages, and 2 years in succession selected as the man of the year for Mexico. That's all his medals. And I should have gone to Mazatlan. He wanted me to go down there anyway. He was a sturdy old fellow. I could tell you stories. To retell them, if I told them, then there would be no punchline and no laugh. But the way he could tell them his stories was wonderful. Jack Bennett, and twice I met him twice in Los Angeles, and once in San Francisco, when the night before he'd been out with my friend Jack McDonald, you know, at supper on the town. And Jack, I got in town that next day, he said, "Bill, well, Jack Bennett's in town and we'll take you out tonight." So he phoned and he said, "I want to see Bill, I'm not going out again tonight." He turns 93 about that time, a vigorous. He jumped, he went on a boat to come up here to Vancouver, and it foundered, and some lives were lost, and he was then way in his 80s, and he swam 3/4 of a mile ashore.
Now, somebody the other day gave this estimation of Wallace LaFoe, that he was Canada's greatest Marxist. Do you think so?
I don't like two terms like that. You see, they pick on a man and they hang a label on him. Of course, the capitalist press gave Bill Pritchard the credit of being Canada's greatest orator. And they took the wreath from Bennett and handed it to me. And I don't like to be considered the successor of William Bedford Bennett.
Richard.
Pritchard, yeah. Oh. No, I'll tell you, though, up at the university you visited yesterday, they have a bookshop. And that bookshop, for many years, was run by a man named Morgan, who's trade was that of a plumber. I became plumbing inspector in Vancouver and then sanitary inspector chief. And when he was through with that, then he went to the university. And he wrote a thesis himself. I don't know what degree he got. It was silly. What he wanted to do and did was to translate a short book of Arturo Labriola, the son of Professor Labriola, who was the tutor of